to sleep as long as possible. When he feels himself rousing, the sunlight flush against the closed blinds, he wraps his pillow around his ears and lifts the blanket over his head, leaving a small opening for his mouth and nose, like a cowl. He doesn't want to wake up because the hours between 8 and 10 are the hardest to get through. The streets below crowded with people going off to work, while he has nothing to do, nothing to look forward to. So if he can get through it by sleeping, he can curb the panic he feels every morning. He won't go to the bathroom because he knows if he does, he may never get back to sleep. And when he finally does wake up, it's with a sense of sadness that he has to face another day. Then comes the period of lying in bed, holding the remote, watching television. He flicks from one station to another, past game shows, cartoons, reruns of popular old programs, and local interviews. While he watches, he forgets himself. It's almost like sleeping again. And he imagines millions of the unemployed and the aged looking at television to stop thinking. But for him, it doesn't hold. His mind is too active. So he gets up and begins pacing from one end of his apartment to the other. By now it might be 11:30 in the morning, and to pass the time, he'll go into the kitchen and cook himself an omelet. He may not even be hungry, but he wants to give himself something to do, to keep busy, to fill at least another 30 or 40 minutes. Or sometimes he'll walk to a luncheonette near his apartment, wearing his dark sunglasses, ratty overcoat, running shoes, and baseball cap. He'll buy a paper at the counter, order a meal, and sit as far away from other people as possible, reading and eating. When he was younger, he looked at other people going about their business and thought, "You poor losers, you're rushing to do something, to get somewhere, and where are you going? You're hurrying to work where you'll have to kiss somebody's ass and somebody else will stab you in the back. You're racing to make enough money so you can rush out and spend it. And I don't have to worry about any of that. I'm a free spirit. I can observe the human comedy on the street and just float through it as if it's my own little movie." But over the years, his attitude changed. He began to feel lonely and envious because everyone else seemed to be moving in some direction, making an effort. And now he sees them in the mornings, dressed in business suits, carrying briefcases, filing into subway stations, and looking for taxis. And he feels like a person from another planet. He went to a small college in Iowa. It was in the 60s. He didn't take part in the marches and sit-ins, but still saw himself as a rebel. In his freshman year, he drove to Manhattan on Thanksgiving. It was a long trip, more than 14 hours. The car was packed with students. Their first stop was a service area just outside Cleveland. They sat at the counter of a Howard Johnson's restaurant looking at a sign that listed more than 50 kinds of ice cream. And to the amusement of his friends, he asked for even more exotic flavors. "Could I please have a broccoli mint apple pie cobbler? I think I'd prefer the orange sunburst chicken nut fudge crunch. Or perhaps the pistachio fried egg okra delight with the dehydrated applesauce topping and stewed lungs." It started as an accident. There was a stack of brownies on the counter wrapped in cellophane. He took one and meant to pay for it, but realized on his way back to the car that he'd forgotten. Rather than go back, he unfolded the cellophane and ate it. At the next service area, he stole two more brownies to share with his friends. At the third stop, he borrowed a purse from one of the girls, held it in his lap at the counter, filled it with a dozen brownies from the display platter, and passed it back to her. Finally, just outside New York, he emptied an entire platter of brownies into his book bag. The restaurants were so busy that no one noticed. As they drove, he and his classmates munched on the chocolate. But they could only eat so many, and he soon found himself with a surplus. By the time he got back to college, he'd accumulated so many brownies, he thought he'd build something out of them. But he didn't know what. All he knew was that he needed more. So whenever he drove home for vacations, he stopped at every Howard Johnson's coming and going to steal as many brownies as he could. And over a period of a year, he amassed 2 steamer trunks full. The brownies got hard and stale. He banded them together, the way they stack money in bank heist movies. Eventually, his brownie collection became famous. Students from all over the campus came to look at it. His only problem was that, by next fall, the brownies began to stink up his room. The odor of stale chocolate was in his clothes, his shoes, his hair. He couldn't stand the smell and decided to get rid of them. But he didn't want to just throw them out. He wanted to do something whimsical and original to feed his reputation as a campus legend. Finally, he came up with an idea. He'd return them. So that Thanksgiving vacation, he placed one of the trunks in his car and set out on the journey home with a new sense of mission. Now, every time he stopped at a Howard Johnson's, he would fill the pockets of his shirt, overcoat, and pants with brownies, walk in, sit down at the counter, and while he sipped a Coke, furtively empty his pockets, adding his own stale brownies to those displayed on the platters in front of him. Soon all the students knew of his project. He was the talk of the college. They thought it was a great idea, and they were all behind him. Both Thanksgiving and Christmas went well. He managed to return 1.5 trunks of brownies because he and his friends stopped at every service area in both directions between Cedar Rapids and New York. Then, during Easter, he arrived at the first Howard Johnson's rest stop, his pockets filled with the dry chocolate squares, but the brownie platters were gone. He was stunned. Were they onto him? He looked around, half expecting to be seized by security guards, when he noted, with relief, that the brownies had been moved to the caddy counter in front of the cash register. It was too risky to add his stolen brownies to the stacks in front of the cashier, so he sat down at the counter and ordered dinner. When he finished his meal, he polished his plate with his napkin and, holding the plate on his lap, stacked his brownies, Howard Johnson style, on it, put it back on the counter, paid the check, and left. At the next plaza, his friends helped him. They argued heatedly with the cashier, claiming they'd been overcharged, while he reached into the deep pockets of his overcoat, drew out dozens of stale brownies, and placed them on the shelves over the lollipops, caramello bars, and maple sugar people. And by the summer, he managed to return every brownie he'd stolen. And it wasn't long before Howard Johnson's restaurants were converted into cafeterias with pay toilets and cheap air dryers in the bathrooms. And not long after that he saw them closing down. Although he realized it was because of the expanding fast food industry, the McDonald's, Burger King's, Pizza Hut's, Taco Bell's, Kentucky Fried Chicken outlets, and all the rest, he felt a bittersweet sense of victory. He knew he played his small part in the decline of a great American institution. He acts as if he were at a resort in the mountains. When someone calls, he says, "So, how are you going to get up here? Are you going to take the train?" "You're in the city," I tell him, "in a hospital." He sighs. Then he says, "Let's go out to the pool, okay?" "We can't. We have to stay here." "Why?" "Because you have an IV in your arm." "I never had that. What's that?" "Look, it's right next to you. See?" He looks down at a tube running into the back of his hand. "Yes, they're good people here," he says. Then he gets an idea. The hospital should branch out, open up a chain of franchises, and he'll be one of the main investors. "What's the name of the chief resident here?" "Brown." He draws a scrap of paper from his pocket, looks at it, and asks, "What's he invoicing now? What's his margin?" movie comes on at 1 p.m. and he turns on the TV to see what it is. He won't look in the paper in advance because he doesn't want to know ahead of time that it might be a film he won't like. He wants to hold out hope for as long as possible that he'll be able to fill the hours between 1 and 3. And sometimes he watches television all afternoon, lying in bed with the blinds closed until the sun goes down behind the buildings. If a friend is planning to drop by, he'll take out his guitar and amp, plug them in, and cover his desk with scribbled yellow pads and a phone book, so it looks as if he's been writing songs and making calls. But if no one's expected, and he doesn't want to watch the 1 o'clock movie, he goes out for a walk, unwashed and unshaven, envying the Skid Row bums he passes, because they have nothing to worry about anymore, having left their careers and futures far behind. And he thinks it might be a relief to be a tramp, wrapped in a blanket, lying in the warmth of a subway grating, listening to the sound of a passing train. In the evenings, he likes to get stoned because his sense of time disappears. He no longer worries about how he'll make it through the next few hours, or that life is passing him by and he's blowing it with each minute he lives, or that more and more people are younger than he is. Doctors, lawyers, journalists, artists, professors, businessmen. He can just sit in his living room feeling a mild, euphoric buzz. He doesn't mind the mess. He doesn't worry about putting things away. He plays his guitar or listens to music and recalls amusing things from the past. After he left college in Iowa, he came back to Manhattan. It was autumn. He moved into a small walk-up apartment in the village and enrolled in a few courses at Columbia. His mother paid his tuition and helped out with expenses. But he needed a job. One afternoon, he checked the student bulletin board, and he saw a listing for a part-time janitor and gardener at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine. The church, its rectory, school, and outbuildings were spread over 6 acres of land near the Columbia campus. He applied for the position and was hired. Each day, he'd leave his apartment at 5 a.m., wearing his Madras jacket, chinos, and white bucks. Carrying a briefcase, he'd ride the subway to 110th Street and walk from Broadway to the church. The city was dark, the street lamps still lit. The wind whipped the trees. He liked being out early in the morning. After changing into his work clothes, his first job was to clean the rectory. He mopped the hallways, vacuumed the offices, and emptied the wastebaskets. There were radios in most of the rooms, and he tuned them all to his favorite pop station, working his way through the building to the sounds of rock and roll. He usually got to the kitchenette around 6:30 a.m., just as he was growing hungry. While he cleaned up, he'd help himself to a few cookies, a cupcake, or a donut from the refrigerator. After a few weeks, his boss, Mr. Wilkes, asked to speak with him because people had complained that food was missing. He denied taking anything and stopped doing it, but not right away, so suspicion wouldn't fall on him. When he finished his janitorial tasks around 7 a.m., he took his rake and sack, walked out onto the grounds, and while the sun rose and the city came to life, he raked leaves, stuffed them into his bag, and burned them in the incinerator. After work, he changed back into his student outfit and went to a campus hangout called the Brass Rail. He took a table in the corner, ate breakfast, and studied until his first class. It was there he met Greta, a tall, blonde German waitress. She often looked pale and wasted after a night of partying. She smoked Camels, wore no makeup, picked her teeth with a toothpick, and drank a lot of coffee. Her hands shook slightly. She told him she'd been on her own for years, ever since her father, a left-wing intellectual, had lost his teaching position in Hamburg. She liked to drink Black Russians, listen to classical music, and talk about the men she dated and the places they made love. She also spoke of becoming an artist, but he never saw her paint anything, and she never showed him any of her work. Early one morning, after spending the night in her room near the campus, he said, "Come with me. I'll show you what I do." They walked to the church. It was late fall, cold and still dark out. He led her into the rectory, and she helped him clean up. He felt very decadent and romantic, a Jewish student gardener working alongside a crazy German woman in a church built in honor of a Christian saint, while rock and roll echoed from radios throughout the building. She helped him mop the hallways, and they scrubbed the laundry room and cleaned the office of the newsletter. When he started vacuuming the library, she stood behind him, gently caressing the back of his neck. Then she took off her sweater, unfastened the top buttons of her blouse, and kissed him. He made some coffee in the kitchenette, walked back to the library, and she sat down on his lap and began to fondle him. He kissed her, slipped her blouse from her shoulders, and removed her tights and shoes. Then she lay down on a large oak table in the study and whispered to him in German. He unbuckled his belt and unzipped his fly, his pants dropping in a heap at his feet. He looked down at her, savoring the sight of her body, when the door at the other end of the room opened and an old man in a flowing black robe appeared. Greta continued to moan in German. The priest took one long, steady look, turned away, his gown making a swishing sound, and was gone. A week later, Mr. Wilkes fired him for stealing food. He said, "We checked with the night watchman and we know there's no other way the food could have disappeared. I'm afraid you're through." No mention was made of Greta in the library. So he lost his job. Then Greta left town. He never found out where she went and never heard from her again. Last night, a nurse telephoned from the hospital. She said he refused to take his medication and demanded to go home. Soon they'd be forced to restrain him. I said, "I'll be right over." I found him sitting in a wheelchair wearing his raincoat and hat. His hands were trembling. He reached into his pocket, drew out a scrap of paper with a number on it, looked at it and said, "I don't have a cent on me. Lend me $10, will you?" "What do you need money for?" "I've got to get to Puerto Vallarta on business. It's nighttime. No banks are open. They'll open for me." I walk to the window. "Look out. What do you see?" "What do you see?" "I see darkness outside. The banks aren't open now. It's nighttime." "It is what I want it to be." "It can't be. You can't make it day. You can't make the banks open." His body sagged. Then he drew out another scrap of paper, looked at it and said, "Let's go out to the pool." When he's out walking, he wanders into a drugstore and browses through magazines, looks at clocks, cassette players, and radios, locked behind plate glass, and tries on different pairs of sunglasses. The sunglasses he now wears he stole from the drugstore on the corner. He put them on one day, looked at himself in the mirror, liked them, and continued to wander around the store wearing them, the price tag dangling down over his nose, until he finally walked out. Once he tried on a pair of jeans in a dressing room, tore off the plastic tag that sets off the alarm, put his own jeans on over them, walked to the front to pick up the bags he checked, flirted with a sales girl, and left. Sometimes he goes to a large, busy luncheonette, orders scrambled eggs, pancakes, bacon, sausages, home fried potatoes, toast, and coffee, eats his meal, gets a bill for it, moves to another seat at the counter, and orders coffee and a Danish. Then, at the cashier, he pays the amount on the second check. One afternoon, he found a purse with $50 in credit cards, and he pocketed the money and sold the cards to a friend. It happened while he was playing the ukulele in a department store. He wore a t-shirt with the store's logo on it and sang the store's theme song. He was posted next to the gift shop and managed over a period of a few weeks to steal brass paperweights, leather-bound address books, calendars, pens, and boxes of stationery. Then, for a while, he had a job raising money for a symphony orchestra. He sat at one of about 20 tables with beige telephones in a fluorescent-lit room and called season ticket holders, subscribers to the monthly magazine, and people who'd bought a gift from the orchestra catalog. He worked from 8 to 11 p.m. at $4.50 an hour, sitting in a group of middle-aged women, college students, unemployed actors, failed pianists, and people who claimed they were businessmen, professors, and lawyers, who for one reason or another were between engagements. There were also a few street people. One of them, a black man whose eyes would sometimes roll up into his head in the middle of a phone call, sat at a desk pointing his forefinger and squinting as if he were aiming a pistol. Then he would depress his thumb, shooting down his co-workers one by one. When you go into a subway station, you enter a hole in the ground. Every sound echoes. You feel as if you're in an altered state of consciousness. Time seems to stand still, yet your sense of it is heightened. You look around and see that people's behavior is similar to that of animals in cages. Some pace absently up and down, while others sit on benches or lean against a wall or a pillar, staring blankly into space. The platform is dimly lit. There are tile walls, concrete floors, and an endless succession of columns and girders. Lines of force stretching in front of you and down into the tunnel. Early morning in the subway is a special time. The station seemed cleaner, the air fresher. From 4:30 to 6:30 a.m. are the hours when the night and day people cross paths, when the tired partygoers, musicians, waitresses, janitors, night watchmen, pimps, and whores meet the early morning shift of workers, domestics, and students who have to travel a long way. He liked standing on the platform and riding the trains at that time. And that's what he misses most when he thinks about his job at the church. He likes the idea of an underground city, the sense of living in an artificial environment that might have been built after a nuclear holocaust, with long stretches of hallways, multi-level ramps, railings, and escalators. In some of the larger stations, they sell food, clothes, books, records, newspapers, magazines, and candy. You can buy a token, go into the subway, and travel anywhere under the city for years. You can live below the surface of the earth. Christianity's first expression in Rome was beneath the surface of the city, in the catacombs, where Christians buried their martyrs, in the great cities of the dead. Yesterday, he was having lunch in the solarium. The minute he saw me, tears came into his eyes. He was sitting in a wheelchair, a plastic tray in front of him. He took a spoonful of grapefruit and dropped it in his milk. Then he poured his coffee into his soup. "What am I doing?" he said. "What am I doing?" Later, I asked him, "Do you want any more to eat?" He looked up. "First, I have to know what eating is." He said it with a smile, as if he were cracking a joke. We'll be right back. years ago, his mother disconnected her phone and swallowed over 100 Tylenols. When her friend Dora called, the phone just rang and rang. After dialing the number for 3 hours, Dora walked to her apartment a few blocks away and buzzed the door. She had keys to both locks. After waiting a minute, she took a deep breath and let herself in. She found his mother, barely conscious, lying on the bed. Spread out beside her were bank books, financial statements, and a will. "Let me die," she moaned. "I want to die." "Well, if you're going to go, dear, you better go quickly," Dora said, "because I'm calling 911. 10 minutes later, an ambulance arrived, and his mother, now unconscious, was taken to the hospital. He was asleep when Dora called. "Your mother's in New York Hospital," she said. "It's an emergency." He took a cab uptown. A young intern met him at the door of the intensive care unit. He told him that by the time they'd pumped his mother's stomach, she'd already digested most of the medication. At this point, it was a matter of waiting. "She'll probably be out at least 8 to 10 hours," he said, "so you might as well go home. There's nothing anyone can do." He suspected the doctor had contempt for suicides. He could see it in his eyes, hear it in his voice. He also felt implicated, as if the doctor thought that he, in some way, might be responsible. "I'd like to see her," he said. They walked down a corridor to a room where she lay on a bed in a curtained-off area. She had a tube down her throat, attached to a ventilator that was breathing for her. Her throat looked swollen, and her head was bent as if her neck had been broken. Electrodes were fastened to her chest, and he could see the lit pattern of her heartbeat as it moved across the screen. There was an IV in her arm hooked to a bag on a pole. A tube from a catheter drained urine from her bladder. She was wearing a hospital gown and looked oddly small, as if she'd shrunk. He stared at her and remembered his last visit to her home 1 week earlier. She'd begun to weep as she spoke about his dead father, but he hadn't been able to comfort her. If he'd seen a stranger crying in the street, he would have responded with more feeling. But he and his mother didn't have that kind of relationship. They didn't touch, kiss, or embrace, and the thought of reaching out and holding her hand filled him with dread. He'd never forgotten the childhood memory of her passing him to Evelyn, the maid, who hugged him so warmly to her bosom that he experienced a sense of pleasure, a feeling, for the first time, of being loved. "It's me," he whispered, but he doubted she could hear him. He left the room and met Dora in the cobblestone courtyard behind the hospital. It was a beautiful evening in mid-October. They could see the East River with the lights of Roosevelt Island reflected in it. He knew Dora felt troubled by having called 911, and he tried to reassure her. "How can you sit in a room and let someone die? You couldn't have lived with yourself if you'd done it." But secretly, he felt ambivalent. If his mother had been so depressed that she tried to kill herself, he knew she was going to be furious if she came out of it and had to face life all over again. And then, of course, he'd have to face her all over again, too. He also knew she had some money and that much of it could be depleted on medical bills. But if she died right away, he might come into a fine inheritance. On the other hand, he would have to make arrangements for a funeral. He would have to call a mortuary, place an obituary in the paper, send out invitations for the service, face all of his mother's old friends, and decide where to bury her and in what kind of plot. "How am I going to handle it?" he wondered. "I don't know the first thing about it." She remained in a coma for the next few days while he wondered what to do. Should he pretend nothing had happened or tell his co-workers and his boss at the symphony? It was such a good story. His mother had tried to kill herself. She was in a coma in the hospital. It was an event. Everyone would want to know what had happened. They'd feel sorry for him. And finally, he had to tell. And eventually, as he came to tell one person after another, he began to develop a feeling for the story. For so long, his life had seemed empty, and this event had suddenly given it flavor and zest. He didn't want to use his mother's pain to get attention, but that's exactly what he was doing. He didn't feel like eating and he couldn't sleep. It reminded him of finals in college where you lose track of time and don't know what day it is. You're haunted by the sense that you're not doing enough, but there's nothing you can do because there's no way in a few days you can ever catch up on a semester's worth of work, and you might as well not even bother to try. So he just went numb. He didn't want to think, "Oh God, I wish he'd die." And the only way to prevent that was not to think at all. Every day he'd walk down the hospital corridors and look into rooms where bedridden people slept, read magazines, and gazed at television. Some of the rooms were filled with flowers. He'd pass recovering patients strolling the hallways arm in arm with members of their families, and then he'd enter the room where his mother lay unconscious. And now, for the first time, he could sit beside his mother and she had nothing to say. It was a strange feeling because she was a woman who, in the company of others, always held forth. At La Brasserie 2 weeks ago, as they waited for the soup, she'd begun to sing The Linden Tree by Schubert in the original German. Embarrassed by the stares of people at nearby tables, he interrupted her. "What do the words mean in English?" he said. She looked off and smiled. "Down there by the fountain, at the gate, stands the linden tree. I dreamed in its shadow, so many a sweet dream." Then she sighed. "My teacher told me I was her best student. She wanted me to attend the conservatory. But you know how it was in those days. A woman was supposed to marry and raise children. No one cared about my career. Then I met your father, and that was that. If I'd had the chance to sing professionally, my life might have been completely different. Yes, I wouldn't have been born," he thought. "Maybe I'd be singing at the Metropolitan now," she said. "I've lost some of my technique, but the purity and the sweetness are still there." Then she sang the second verse, and as her voice rose, he began to squirm and cringe and thought if he had to stay in his chair one more second, he might begin to scream. From 4 to midnight, the nurse on duty was a young woman from Switzerland called Helga. She had blue eyes, ruddy cheeks, and long blonde hair wrapped in a braided coil. To him, she looked like a Teutonic snow goddess. He imagined meeting her in an empty operating room. She'd lie down on the table, unwrap her braid, and let him tie her up with it. After his mother's death, he got a job singing and playing the guitar in a small Upper West Side bar. The room was dimly lit. There were 9 wooden tables with candles and vases of flowers. The kitchen served hamburgers, steaks, 2 chicken dishes, and steamed vegetables. At night, when he showed up, the kitchen would be closing down, and there would be only hardcore drinkers left. He'd hook his guitar to 1 input of the speaker and a lavalier microphone clipped below his collar to the other. The waitresses sitting at the bar, smoking and drinking with their boyfriends, wouldn't bother to clean up, and half-empty glasses, greasy plates, and ashtrays full of cigarette butts still littered the tables. He'd climb onto a raised platform and begin to sing, playing to the backs of about 5 or 6 people slumped at the bar. By the middle of his second set, a ripple of late-night drinkers would come in, mostly students from Columbia University. Then, at around 2 a.m., somebody who'd appeared to be listening intently would start to sway and fall over with his glass, overturning his stool. Or a group of people would clap and yell and begin to dance, and he'd think they were really getting into his music, until he realized that they were so drunk they would have done the same thing no matter who was performing. There was also a bum in filthy, soot-covered clothes who used to stop by. He'd stand in the doorway, bobbing his head. For the first few weeks, he thought he was bobbing his head to the music, but it turned out to be a nervous condition. But he did have a few fans, two young men in their mid-20s who'd shout, "Rock and roll, rock and roll," when he arrived at midnight. They'd become his pals ever since he'd let them join him on stage for a set one night. There was no air conditioning and no ventilation, and everyone smoked. People smoked cigarettes all night, and the following day, not only did his clothes and guitar smell of smoke, but his eyes felt seared. The manager, Manuel, was a Chilean with the face of an old prize fighter. He had scar tissue over one eye and a broken nose. He liked to think of himself as an impresario who was fostering new talent. Manuel gave him free drinks, dinner, and $15 a night. But as time passed and Manuel lost money, he began to turn on him. If he took too long a break between sets, he'd come over and say, "What do you want? What do you do? You come in here, you sit, you talk. How can I make money if you don't get up and play?" The bar began to deteriorate. Manuel cut back on the candles and the flowers. He took the spotlight away and used the current for a Budweiser sign he put in the window. Rats in the kitchen began to wander into the dining area, and roaches and water bugs streamed from holes in the walls and floors. One night, he saw a huge roach crawl out of his guitar, and he tried to kill it with his pick while he was performing.
Filled with garbage. He pretended it was a game,
that they were having fun, going on an adventure, and the boy tried not to show his fear by playing along with him. But the sun had gone down, and it was getting cold. He took the boy's hand, and they walked to an old-fashioned phone booth on the corner. He lifted the receiver, dialed zero, and heard a recording. To place a call, please deposit 25 cents. It was his mother's voice. At first, he couldn't believe it. Then he remembered his mother worked for the phone company, recording messages on tape. It occurred to him that if he could get an operator, he might be able to reach her. He tapped the cradle until he heard a woman pick up. "This is operator 473. "Hello," he said. "My mother works for the phone company in the recording department." He gave her name and asked if they could be connected. But the operator had never heard of her and couldn't find her on the employee roster. She asked what number he was calling from. He looked at the phone. "There isn't a number listed here," he said. "I wish I could help you," she said, "but I cannot connect you with anyone unless you place a quarter in the slot." "Look, we're lost. We don't know how to get home. I don't have any change." "There's nothing more I can do," she said. "Let me speak to your supervisor," he said angrily. "My supervisor isn't here," she answered. "Besides, I'm acting supervisor." He remembered when he and the boy had first gone out. It had been sunny and warm. Now it was getting cold, and it smelled like snow. The boy came into the booth with him, and they closed the door to keep the wind out. "There's one thing you can do," the operator said. "Hang up and call 555-4327. It doesn't require any change. Maybe they'll be able to help you." He hung up, dialed the number, and it was busy. He hung up, waited 30 seconds, and tried again. This time, it just rang. He hung up and dialed zero, but no one answered there either. After listening to the phone ring for 3 minutes, he began jiggling the cradle. Finally, in frustration and rage, he slammed down the phone, and the receiver shattered. By now, it was dark outside. The street lamps were broken, and there were still no lights in the windows. He decided to look for help in the neighborhood. But the door of the booth was stuck, and the harder he tried to open it, the more it seemed to seal shut. The boy was pleading with him, "Don't push it this way, push it that way," when suddenly the phone began to ring. He stared at the broken receiver helplessly, feeling inept, frightened, and ashamed, because he knew he was responsible for everything that had gone wrong, and the boy, who was crying, would never forget it. And they huddled in the booth, a raw wind blowing outside, a light snow beginning to fall, the phone ringing and ringing and ringing. was younger, he ate just about everything. He was proud of his iron stomach. Then, when he was in his late 30s, he drank a Coke, belched, and felt a pain below his left breast, near his heart, as if a bubble had burst inside him. And it was a completely unfamiliar feeling. For years, he'd seen ads for Alka-Seltzer, Pepto-Bismol, and Maalox, and had felt disdain for people who had trouble with their digestion. But now, at various times during the day, he takes different kinds of antacids while continuing to eat at fast food joints. When he goes to McDonald's, he'll have a Big Mac, large fries, and a medium Coke. At Kentucky Fried Chicken, three pieces of extra crispy chicken, coleslaw, and a Coke. At Pizza Hut, a small plain pizza and a root beer. Or at Subway, he orders tuna with oil, mayonnaise, green peppers, onions, and olives on a huge roll. Then he'll go to a chocolate chip cookie store and buy a half dozen cookies. Or stop at a Dunkin' Donuts for a donut and coffee. Or go to a Haagen-Dazs for a cone or a sundae. Recently, he's put on so much weight that he gets winded putting on his clothes and has begun wheezing like an asthmatic. He's afraid to bend over because something might pop or break, or straightening back up, he might see stars, go into tunnel vision, brownout. When he's sitting in a fast food restaurant where the furniture is bolted to the floor and he can't back the chair away from the table cuts into his belly. He'll catch sight of himself in a mirror, sitting in that unwashed and unshaven state, and he looks like one of those weird fat guys in a restaurant. Passing by people in doorways never used to be a problem. He just swiveled to one side. But now he takes up the entire space himself, and he can't fit into his clothes anymore. His ties don't fall, but slope outward, resting on his belly. And when he's lying in bed eating dinner, his stomach serves as a tray. He can put plates, silverware, and a napkin on it. The more weight you put on, he says, the more you surround yourself with another layer, so you can't be reached. It's like insulation. He sits in a chair, holding his huge stomach in his hands. Yes, I feel it stands as a monument to my excess. But making love has become difficult. The missionary position is now a problem because he's afraid he'll suffocate someone. And if, on the other hand, he lies on his back, it won't be easy for her because she'll have to straddle his giant belly. A few weeks ago, he was caressing a prostitute he picked up in a bar. They were fully clothed on the sofa of her apartment when he had an orgasm. As he got up, he saw a red stain on the lap of her white dress and assumed she was having her period. But in the bathroom, his pants and underpants soaked with blood, he realized it had come from him. You know, when I think about myself and the life I've led, I feel self-loathing, shame, disgust. I'm a waste and a failure, he says. But when I imagine myself as a character in a novel, well, I think I'm pretty interesting, kind of offbeat, intriguing, entertaining. There's a lady who walks the halls in a polka dot dress with a bright cherry collar. Her eyes are watery. Her breathing is labored. The last time I visited, she sat down next to him, picked up his hand, and put his finger in her nose. I pulled it out and said, No, he doesn't like that. And they stared at each other like a pair of little children. Then she picked up his hand again, put it between her legs, and held it there, very quietly.
Suck. das noch einmal. Sag's noch einmal, schämst du dich? Ich schäme mich nicht, ich habe kein Gefühl von Schande, nur Erschrecken. Ich bin erschrocken, wie du das gesagt hast. So ein ganz tiefer Schrecken ist in mir. Ist das Liebe, glaubst du? Der Schrecken, die Sehnsucht, das Gefühl, das ich habe, dass ich in dich hinein schmelzen will. Ich will aufgehen in dir, nicht mehr ich sein, sondern du werden. Ich fühle so eine Sehnsucht, so eine wilde Sehnsucht, dass du mich martern sollst, dass du mich schlagen sollst, mir wehtun sollst, in mich hineindrängen sollst. Das muss Liebe sein. Ich liebe dich, ja. Willst du mein Geliebter sein? Kannst du mich so anfassen? So deine Zunge. Sie ist ganz heiß und rau. Du, das ist so wie ein Tier. So, wenn du da so meinen Hals hinunterlegst. Ich fühle es, ich kann es fühlen. Ganz in meinen Zehen. Innen. So, kannst du fühlen, wie meine Haut heiß ist? Bist du erschrocken? Ich bin's auch. Aber ich schäme mich nicht, ich bereue es nicht. Ich kann es nicht bereuen, ich fühle dich überall, immer, auf ewig. Ich werde dich nie vergessen, nie. Ich will den Eindruck behalten, deine Schäme. Deine Knochen, deine Härte, deine Wut, deine Zähne, oh, wie sie beißen, wie sie heiß und schrecklich auf meinen Achseln zucken. Geliebter, noch mehr und mehr, halt mich so und sag mir, dass du mich liebst. Sag mir, dass ich die Einzige sein werde für immer, immer, mein Geliebter. Jetzt weine ich auch, jetzt kommen mir die Tränen, jetzt bin ich ganz nass, überall.